Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ticker symbol C was the hot property on the New York Stock Exchange today by a country mile. And amazingly, more people were buying than selling, even though Citigroup reported a disastrous quarterly profit this morning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 19th of January today. And I suppose it is a sign of just how bad things were when a bank reports a multi-billion dollar loss and its stock goes up. Citigroup announced this morning it lost more than $7.5 billion in the final months of 2009. And yet, shares gained more than 3.5% today. Most of that red ink, it ought to be said, actually came from paying the bailout money back to the federal government, and Citi said losses from bad consumer loans are starting to stabilize. So, less bad news clearly being a good thing, traders decided today's report was reason enough to buy Citi shares. Oh, but when Citi might actually start making money again? We asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to look into that.
Even if you don't count the cost of repaying bailout money, Citigroup still lost more than $1 billion last quarter, but its stock jumped 3.5% today. Investors may have been heartened by cautious word from CEO Vikram Pandit that losses from bad loans are showing signs of improvement.
Some credit fundamentals appear to be stabilizing, particularly internationally, but U.S. consumer credit remains an issue.
Analyst Jamie Peters with Morningstar didn't see much to cheer about.
My opinion is that people are simply, you know, heaving a sigh of relief that Citigroup did not come over and, you know, slam somebody with an unexpected charge.
Citigroup actually turned a profit 3 out of 4 quarters last year. But Gerard Cassidy with RBC Capital Markets says that was mostly from selling off assets as the bank tried to downsize. He says as the lending environment recovers, Citi should start really making money again this year.
Like any bank recovery, we have to crawl before we walk, and you have to see a deceleration in the credit deterioration before you actually see an improvement. But we expect this in the first quarter of 2010 for some banks to actually start to show improvement in credit.
Investors will get a better idea of when that might be when Bank of America and Wells Fargo report their earnings tomorrow. But even if credit conditions improve, banks say they won't be able to make as much money on consumer debt. They say they'll lose hundreds of millions of dollars when changes from new credit card legislation take effect next month. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The long-sought but never consummated deal for Kraft to buy the English chocolatier Cadbury has finally come to a conclusion. Kraft announced this morning a sweetened offer of more than $19.5 billion is what it took to get the deal done. It will be offering more cash instead of stock this time around, the stock having been a sticking point for the biggest owner of Kraft shares, Warren Buffett. Interestingly, investing directly in the billionaire's holding company is about to get a whole lot cheaper. Berkshire Hathaway shareholders are expected to approve a stock split of Berkshire's Class B shares tomorrow. They closed at a mere $3,332 a piece today. After the split, they will sell for a measly $66 a pop. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports the move could attract a whole lot more short-term investors.
Owning a piece of Warren Buffett's empire has never been cheap. Berkshire Hathaway's A shares were trading today for around $99,000 each. Buffett started issuing the lowlier B shares in 1996 to give small investors a piece of the action. But even those stocks sell for thousands. Tomorrow, Berkshire shareholders will vote to split the B shares 50-for-1. That means somebody owning one baby Berkshire will suddenly have 50 babies instead. NYU finance professor Aswat Damodaran says the cheaper stock price will make baby Berkshires more accessible to the masses, but they're still a second-class stock.
The problem remains that you don't get a say in how the company is run if you don't have a vote.
B shareholders don't have a vote at Berkshire stockholder meetings. Still, the stock's cheaper price means more Berkshire shares will be bought and sold more frequently. But this split also helps smaller shareholders at Burlington Northern, the railroad Berkshire is buying, avoid higher taxes when Buffett pays them. Paul LaMonica, editor-at-large at CNNMoney.com, says the split doesn't alter the fundamentals.
It really doesn't change anything about that company's value, even though it may be quote-unquote cheaper to buy one individual share. The company is still worth the same amount the day after the split that it was before.
Buying Berkshire Hathaway means investing in everything from underwear maker Fruit of the Loom to soft-serve giant Dairy Queen. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The White House announced last night President Obama's State of the Union address is set for next Wednesday. That'll be the 27th. Unemployment is one of the many things the president is sure to talk about, and he will probably say that job growth is going to come back sometime this year. If it does happen that way, it'll be thanks in some small part to government hiring. The Census Bureau needs workers to knock on doors and count every single person in the country. And it turns out that the bad job market has given the census its best crop of door knockers in many years. From Washington, Brett Neely reports.
During the 2000 census, it was tough finding people who would take the job, says Wendy Button. She's in charge of filling the 1.2 million job openings for the 2010 census. But not so this year.
Then in 2000, they were experiencing some of the lowest unemployment rates they had seen in decades, and we were just seeing the opposite.
The Bureau doesn't have data yet on the education and experience of its temporary workers, but census offices around the country report a flood of overqualified applicants from teachers to lawyers who have lost their jobs. Jared Ewe supervised recruiting at one census office near Denver.
The level of competence and the level of education and experience was impressive, and as a matter of fact, it gave me a little bit of an inferiority complex because, you know, I'm hiring people, and people are working for me who, but 2 years ago, were executives or they, you know, they ran their own business.
Ewe himself wound up at the Census Bureau a year ago after his own small business got hit by the slowing economy.
I am that story of the American entrepreneur who woke up in 2008 wondering exactly what had happened to his business.
Most workers the census is hiring this year get $10 to $25 an hour. Much of the work involves knocking on doors, passing out forms, and verifying addresses. Those who are highly skilled are good communicators and can explain why the census matters. But there's also a knock-on effect in the rest of the labor market, says economist Harry Holzer at Georgetown.
Of course, that bumps out people with even less skills in some of those situations.
Even those people lucky enough to get a census job won't be able to count on it for long. The census wraps up by the end of the year. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the major indices got back everything they lost last Friday and then some. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's entirely possible that the healthcare debate we've been having in this country the past year or so is going to come down to a single vote in the United States Senate, the vote that belongs to the brand new junior senator from Massachusetts. Since it's going to take 60 votes to pass a healthcare bill, the results of today's special election in the Bay State to fill Ted Kennedy's old seat will have outsized influence. So we decided to play a little bit of what if. Here to do that with us is J.B. Silvers. He's a professor of health systems management at Case Western Reserve University. Professor, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
So this is one of those hypotheticals that politicians hate to answer, so I figure I'll ask you instead. You know, if things work out in the next couple of days and weeks that health care does not pass, will this whole debate have been for nothing?
No, I don't think so. On two scores. One, it's clearly has energized an awful lot of people in the healthcare industry to think about how they should be doing business. And secondly, I think people on the private sector who are purchasing healthcare have thought a lot more about how they might change things too. And then finally, in terms of the healthcare policy folks, nothing ever goes away. It just gets kept in a trunk and pulled out next time around.
So what positives have happened in the last year of debate that we've had in this country that you think might actually stick around?
Well, we're going to have to fix the way insurance works, particularly for small business and individuals. The insurance companies don't like it. They agree to change. Clearly, the people involved don't like it. They would like to have a change. The question is, what do you have to do? And that's bringing a lot more people into the pool. So that was the deal. You bring more people in the pool, and we'll stop doing bad things like pre-existing conditions and things of that sort.
Yeah, that is the insurance pool, right? They get 30 million new customers and those profits, and then they take care of some other stuff.
Exactly.
Now, you have in earlier days served as a CEO of an insurance company and a healthcare concern. So let me ask you the get inside the mind question here. Do you think some of the people running healthcare industries in this country now are saying, man, I'll be really happy if this bill does not pass?
There clearly are some in that category. But in this case, it's really interesting because the negotiations that took place ahead of time basically got all the warring parties to the table and struck deals with them that were acceptable, not only acceptable, but actually positive. I've never seen a healthcare reform attempt that actually had most people supporting it, except for the Republicans, of course, including the insurance companies, surprisingly.
So we got people to the table, is what you're saying.
We got them all to the table.
What about the president's statement that he made a number of months ago in which he said, you know, doing nothing on health care is actually a choice. Costs will run away. We will be unable to sustain any of this. Where do you think that's going to take us?
Well, this was, in my view, the first step. This had to do with access and equity. So we got to get everybody at the table, got to get them all covered, and get rid of some of the obvious inequities, particularly around the insurance market. The next step was cost. And this bill did not directly address cost. It indirectly addressed it, but it set in motion some things that would potentially be able to, as we say, bend the curve. It wasn't going to bend it directly, but that's the huge challenge. And he's absolutely right about that. If we don't deal with that, we are in big trouble.
Sounds like you're saying, as painful as it was, this was a good exercise to have gone through.
Oh, I think it absolutely was a critical exercise to go through. It'd be better if we actually came out with something that got passed. But it has definitely changed the way people think. And I don't think, given that there's so much agreement about it, I don't think the hospitals and the docs and all the other parties will go away from it. I think there'll be some residual thing, even if it doesn't pass the way it's structured right now. There is a chance that, unlike the Clinton reforms where we just gave up, this one might actually have a second wave.
J.B. Silvers, he's a professor of health systems management, also banking and finance. He's at the Weatherhead School of Management at Case Western Reserve University. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
Barack Obama took office a year ago tomorrow with a whole pile of things on his plate. Some of them leftovers, some of them his own selections. Stimulate the economy, bail out banks and car companies, fix health care, develop a green economy, and bring down the deficit, all without hitting up the middle class for more taxes. That's a promise he repeated in his first State of the Union address.
If your family earns less than $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year, you will not see your taxes increased a single dime. I repeat, not one single dime.
We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale how the president is doing on that score a year on.
The last decade hasn't been a great one for middle-class Americans. Ever since the end of the technology boom, stagnant wages and high unemployment have left them treading water. And the slow erosion of economic security drove voters like Judith Rucker, a community college teacher in Kansas City, to cast her vote for Barack Obama. She says Obama shares her values.
I think that's one place where Obama is absolutely the best person. I think we can trust his moral judgments.
But Rucker figures there's no way to fix health care and climate change and pay off the debt without reaching into middle-class pockets. She believes Obama will make sure she'll only have to pay her fair share, but her trust only goes so far. She'll be looking for verifiable evidence that the pain is spread evenly.
In order to make me believe that it was being spread equally around, we should have facts and figures given to us, not from special interest groups, but facts that we could depend on that would show us the middle class is paying this much more, those in the upper class are paying this much more.
polls show members of the middle class are gradually losing confidence that Obama's proposals will spread the pain evenly. The latest national poll from Quinnipiac University shows only 39% of people earning $50,000 to $100,000 a year approve of the way he's handling the economy. And that's down from 57% last March. Peter Brown is the poll's assistant director.
Americans don't think the recession's over. They may, you know, economists may think it is. Wall Street may think it is, but voters don't. That's heavily tied to the unemployment rate and the concern about job security.
White House aides say it's too early to hold the president accountable for problems that have been years in the making. His goal is to make sure the middle class thrives in the recovery, but he has yet to turn around its fortunes. So far, Obama has kept his promise to avoid tax increases on middle-income earners, but only by borrowing money to prop up banks and stimulate the economy.
I can't see how we can get out of the current state of our debt without asking the middle class to kick in.
Chris Bergen, the president of tax analysts, predicts Obama will have to break his promise. He says in the future, several White House-backed proposals will hit middle-class pocketbooks. Take health care. Obama supports a hefty excise tax on expensive insurance plans. Despite an agreement to delay the impact on many union health care plans, Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, says that tax is going to hurt.
Instead of taxing the rich, the Senate bill taxes the middle class by taxing workers' health plans.
And Chris Bergen says the president's proposals to charge large banks a fee for the TARP bailout and to make polluting fuels more expensive will most likely be passed along to middle-class customers. Some will argue those costs aren't taxes, but Bergen says don't be fooled.
If it takes money out of the middle class's pocket and it goes to the government, I call it a tax.
How the middle class views the fairness of taxes will make or break the Obama administration's future, says Jim Kessler at the nonpartisan think tank Third Way.
This is the group, more than any other, that swings elections. You can look at them and say, if you lose them by 1 or 2 points, you probably lose the election by 1 or 2 points. They really are the barometer.
Kessler says Obama's economic challenge is similar to the one that faced Ronald Reagan in 1982. A long and deep economic downturn had left the middle class anxious and cost Republicans seats in Congress that year. But the middle class stuck with Reagan's vision that better times were right around the corner. The economy improved, and he won a landslide re-election 2 years later. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Coming up, the drama of home ownership in China.
It's like rules you have to follow. It's not right down in a book or in laws, but it's rules, rules of life.
And the rules say, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained just more than 1% today, 115 points closed at 10,725. NASDAQ jumped 1.4%, 32 points, 2320 at the bell. The S&P 500 snuck up 1.2%, 13 points, ended at 1150. Tech fans caught new device fever today. Apple jumped more than 4% ahead of the expected release of a new tablet computer it's going to issue. Rumors of a new Zune phone from Microsoft drove that company's stock up more than 0.75%. IBM popped up 1.75%. Equipment maker Ciena sparked 11% higher today. 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for December. First Lady Michelle Obama speaks at the annual winter meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses its 2010 aviation security agenda in light of the recent attempted terrorist incident on a Detroit-bound flight. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We will begin our letter segment today with the observation that the president was talking education this afternoon. He used an appearance at a grade school in Virginia to ask Congress for more than $1 billion in additional education funding. Most of that money is going to go to K through 12 programs. We were talking higher education on the program last week and the employment struggles that liberal arts graduates are having. We spoke with Kate Brooks from the University of Texas, Austin. She said a lot of liberal arts PhDs just can't find tenure-track jobs. Bonnie Pomfret from Rehoboth, Massachusetts, is no financial expert.
I'm not a financial expert by any means. You know, I'm a soprano.
But she says there are fewer full-time jobs now because schools are making part-timers pick up the slack.
Nobody really thinks about it. They just turn a job into part-time and someone says, oh, yeah, so-and-so used to do that job. Oh, who's going to do it now? You know, it doesn't seem to happen in a very thoughtful way.
I spoke with Bob Teitelman about Wall Street bonuses last week. Bob is the editor-in-chief of The Deal. And his take was that those big bonuses are necessary evils, that they help keep most of Wall Street's goings-on out in public at regulated firms instead of hedge funds and private equity. Maureen Rubini from St. Petersburg, Florida, used to work for Bank of America, and she says that even though bonuses might help retain top talent, enough is really enough.
You know, I recognize, because I spent so much time in the financial services industry, that, you know, risk and reward is always there, and it makes sense to me to reward risk. But I don't think it's appropriate anymore.
Kathy Broombach-Kaber from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, wrote to comment about another story from last week, the one about how General Motors was really hamstrung by its goal of owning a 29% share of the U.S. auto market. That is a goal that, as we have come to know, didn't work out so well.
Well, it really kind of hit home. I sort of thought I was the only one who felt that goal setting was a bit overrated. I have heard that question asked in every job interview I've ever been in. What are your 5-year goals? What are your 10-year goals? And I've always felt that that was very limiting.
Kaber said she plans to use the story and the research behind it to get past those annoying questions.
I think I need to print out a copy of the study and bring it with me to future interviews.
Yeah, I feel like we ought to run a disclaimer here or something. You know, Marketplace is not responsible for the results of your job interview, something like that. Anyway, if you have heard something on the program that helps you prove a point or that you think misses it altogether, please do tell us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The hottest primetime soap opera on the air in China right now has some of the things you might expect. Infidelity? Yeah, it's got that. Crooked business deals? Check. But a housing bubble? Yeah, it's got that too, because that is the issue on the streets in much of China these days, where home prices, as compared to how much people actually make, may be the highest on the planet. From Shanghai Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Boy meets girl. Boy loses girl to dirty politician. Boy screams. For about 6 months now, the hit primetime series Snail House has delighted audiences around China. There's adultery, bribery, healthy portion of melodrama, but what the characters really chase in this show is money to buy a home. In this scene, a 30-something urban professional bemoans to her husband their itty-bitty rented studio. She wants to own her own place.
You have to in China, you know.
That's Snail House viewer Xu Zhou.
It's like rules you have to follow. It's not write down in a book or in laws, but it's rules of life.
To get hitched in Shanghai, men without property need not apply.
Her parents will ask you, hey, do you have a house in Shanghai? You should buy one.
Private property ownership in socialist China may sound off-key. These masses who defeated the bourgeois landowners in a revolution 60 years ago now all aspire to be bourgeois landowners. But financial journalist Huang Shan explains the new home economics.
I call it ridiculous, but why do so many people buy property? It's because Chinese have limited investment options. Stocks are risky, but real estate can grow 10,000-fold.
Debate rages here if there's a housing bubble. Last year, Shanghai's housing prices rose a stunning 65%. In the TV show, the plot gets busy when our poor, struggling renter gets an envelope with $5,000. It's from her sister. She's been cheating on her boyfriend and sleeping around with a rich, crooked Communist Party member. Song Siming is the political sugar daddy. He seems the obvious villain. But viewers like Guan He, they love him.
Song Siming is really attractive. He's a middle-aged man. He's full of wisdom and, you know, full of power.
Wei.
Even as he takes bribes from property developers, this dirty politician is soft and romantic. He dials up his mistress to piano accompaniment. Yang Junlei teaches comparative cultures at Shanghai's Fudan University.
The show's hit on a very relevant problem in China today, infidelity, mistresses. Pop culture doesn't reflect much of this yet, but Snail House really nails it. It's hot.
Too hot, perhaps, for Chinese censors. Last month, Snail House suddenly went off the air on a few stations. But some channels still air it, and middle-class Chinese still watch, chasing homes of their own, just like the characters. Again, viewer Guan He.
I think everyone need a house, but the problem is whether we can. If I face the same difficulty like the sisters, I may choose to go back to my hometown.
She may quit her dream of making it in Shanghai on account of unaffordable housing. In the end, the soap opera ends badly too. Karma catches up to our two-timing cadre, and he drives his car into an oncoming truck. A foreboding image for a show about China's housing prices, also potentially veering out of control. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note this afternoon, a comment about the economic prospects of the United States of America, courtesy of the bond market. The Treasury Department made its monthly report of overseas holdings of U.S. government debt today, Treasury bills and the like. Two things to point out to you. One is that more foreign countries bought U.S. debt in November than sold it, especially long-term debt. And they bought more than they bought in 2 years, in fact, so that's something. Also, for those who worry that China holds too much of our economic future in its hands, thanks to all the Treasury bills that Beijing has been buying, China is actually cutting back on its purchases of long-term U.S. debt. Not a whole lot, but some, which is something to think about. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 115 points, just over 1%. The NASDAQ up 32 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gained 13 points. That is 1.2%. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, taking very slow steps out of poverty.
In this situation I'm in right now, I've been working on it for a year or so now, and it's looking up. Everything's starting to move in a better direction. So I'm not going to stop now. I'm not letting it derail me now.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.